The Guardian.
Okay, party shirt, laptop.
Yeah, I've got a couple of microphones.
Test tubes?
Yep. I've got my Bunsen burner, you don't need to bring yours.
All right, okay, I'll leave that. Small Hadron Collider.
Check.
Okay, where are my... there they are, socks. Yes, okay. Beards?
Check.
Okay, you got your cord jacket, Andy?
Yep, and with freshly sewn on patches on the elbows.
Marvellous. We're ready for another science festival.
Hello, I'm James Randerson, standing in for Alok Jar, and this is a Science Weekly special for September the 15th, 2008. Now, it's the European capital of culture, and for 1 week only, it's Britain's capital of science. Yes, we're in Liverpool.
Science is interesting and you can learn lots of different things.
I think science is fun and interesting.
Explosives, building stuff.
I think science is really good fun because I like doing experiments.
Science is very interesting. It makes me think about lasers.
Yes, science is fun, and it makes me think of Richard Dawkins. But he's not actually here today, but anyway. This is the BA Festival of Science at the University of Liverpool. On this week's show, obesity and a food crisis.
It's absolutely undoubtedly the case that it's our environment, the change in environment, that has caused the obesity epidemic. And it's only by rechanging our environment that we're going to have any impact on the obesity epidemic.
Science's best-known lord, Professor Robert Winston.
The reason why we study science is because we're uncertain. The reason why many of us are religious is because we're uncertain. Uncertainty is something that we live with, and both science and religion, when they are certain, are at their most dangerous.
And why Britain's faith schools are not helping the fight against terrorism.
Identifying an educational establishment entirely in terms of a particular faith is, I think, potentially very dangerous.
We get stuck into alcohol and binge drinking, purely for research purposes, you understand, and why you forget those bad nights out.
They drink a lot of amount in a short time, which leads often to drunkenness.
At the other end of the scale, there's also research on why people make up false memories.
People who appear to succumb more to these kind of tricks that psychologists play on them tend to be score more highly on measures of what's called fantasy proneness.
Plus, we'll also be checking in with our man in Geneva, as a click of a mouse starts the world's biggest, most expensive, hottest, coldest, fastest, emptiest, and most sophisticated experiment ever. Ever. Ever in the world, ever.
I feel as if we are ending a marathon with a sprint. The pressure has always been high on the LHC, but over the last year, and especially over the last few months, to meet the deadline has been enormous.
Oh yes, let's not forget the rotating tactile stimulator, which has revealed the optimum velocity for stroking pleasure.
We needed a controlled stroker, and as luck would have it, it was the Swedish radiologist who was a classic Swedish bane.
So much we're struggling to fit it all in. This is a Science Weekly special from The Guardian, from Liverpool. First, there was the AskCast that we broadcast from the AAAS Science Festival in Boston. So this one we're calling the BAFTAS FOSCast, which stands for British Association for the Advancement of Science Festival of Science 2008 Cast. We'll see if that one catches on. So, welcome to the Students' Union Bar here at the University. We've set up in the Sarawiwa Bar amongst the discarded pint glasses and the poorly dressed, financially strapped customers. And that's just the journalists. The students aren't even back yet. It's been a busy week with more than 350 of the UK's top scholars attempting to explain to the public what they've been up to. Producer Andy Duckworth and BA Media Fellow Marcus Pierce have been roving the festival to supply your listening pleasure. Throughout the programme, they'll be bringing us short snippets from many of the scientists who've been presenting their work. And if you like what you hear, you can find extended interviews on our website, guardian.co.uk/science/British Association Festival of Science 2008. Sorry about that. You'll find a link to everything from the BA Festival on the blog. We'll also be discussing a few of the more interesting and contentious topics over a snakebite in black with our special guest, Jim Al-Khalili, a theoretical nuclear physicist at the University of Surrey. And I discovered today that you've got an OBE. I didn't know that.
Well, I don't tell everyone, you know. I try to be modest about these things.
That's so cool, you know, to have stuff like that that you don't even brag about. Yeah. Well, Well, actually, I wanted to ask, what you've, you know, you're a veteran of these things, and you've been here for the last few days. What's caught your eye?
What's caught my eye? Well, of course, I've been busy doing my own events here, there, and everywhere. There was a great debate on GM food early in the festival on Sunday, which surprisingly, maybe not, seems to have gone, you know, on the side of GM, and the people who are arguing against it seem to have lost the argument. And I think that's an attitude that seems to have changed over the past decade or so.
So that when you said it was a debate on GM, did that kind of include the audience, and were the audience sort of broadly in favour as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a panel with two for and two against, and the audience, I think, came strongly for. But then this is a science festival, so I guess a lot of people who come here will tend to be pro-science and therefore probably more pro-GM than against.
You mentioned earlier on something, a very interesting event about Islam and science. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, well, this is an event that I was actually speaking at, and it was about science and Islam and the role of the interplay between science and faith and whether they're compatible. Two out of the three speakers, me being one of the two, were very sensible and said that these two can be compatible, and there's no reason why Islam is against science and rational thinking. But it did lead to quite an interesting debate about whether the words in the Quran can be sort of reinterpreted in the light of new scientific discoveries.
And one of the speakers was talking about evolution in particular.
That was very interesting. One of the speakers, he's a physicist. He graduated from Cambridge with a degree in physics, but he's also a part-time imam. And he's the first Muslim I think I've heard talk about this. He said the debate hasn't happened about evolution among Muslims, and he doesn't see any reason why evolution, Darwinian natural selection, isn't or can't be compatible with the teachings of Islam. So it was very fascinating.
Well, there was another talk at the festival that was dealing with issues of faith and Islam. That was Professor David Cantor, who's been looking at Islamist terrorists in India. It's pretty contentious stuff. Producer Andy spoke to him earlier.
Well, the main findings that are beginning to emerge, because it's still the early days of analysis of this material, is that these individuals are often quite reasonably well-educated, certainly average or above-average intelligence, who have some understanding of what it is that they're doing, and are certainly not in any senses mentally disturbed. So it rather challenges the notion of a sort of wide-eyed fanatic who is only doing something that they've been sort of led into by some sort of distant guru figure. But what emerges is that the individuals really find their ways into these actions through social processes, through the people that they become connected with, through feeling that as part of the group that they should be carrying out acts of violence. And there can be a variety of different sorts of group processes involved, varying at one extreme to people just becoming involved really with criminal activity and thinking that if they do something that looks like a terrorist act, this will strengthen their position within the criminal community, at one extreme, to the other extreme of people who are absolutely totally committed to a very fundamentalist interpretation of the Quran, who see themselves as having to carry out these actions from some intensely felt spiritual belief. And between these two extremes, there are a variety of other subgroups, if you like, some of whom are more political in their orientation, and some of whom are just carried along within the social group that they're part of, where this is the sort of things that people do.
And this also relates in some ways to faith schools, doesn't it?
Well, I have to be very clear about this. It is a personal view that comes to me through our research and the studies of many social scientists over the years, that identifying an educational establishment entirely in terms of a particular faith is, I think, potentially very dangerous. That really it's very important that people see themselves in a fully rounded way, and when a school is defined in terms of its faith, that limits the way people think about themselves and provides one pathway that can open up the possibilities for a more radical and extreme way of dealing with the rest of the world.
That was Professor David Cantor there. Now, his study, I thought, was really interesting. It was looking at a set of psychological interviews with 49 I guess you'd call them failed suicide bombers in India, all of them jihadist terrorists. But the thing that got most of the publicity from his talk was he made some very controversial statements about faith schools in the UK, which seemed to me quite a leap to make. And, you know, I don't know, what do you think about that, Jim?
Yes, I agree. I think it's dangerous if you're talking about in the context of suicide bombers or militant jihadists, and then within the same context discussing why you're against faith schools. I think that's incredibly insensitive, and I can't see how one can make that argument. I mean, I don't agree with faith schools, but I wouldn't use words like potentially dangerous. I mean, that's rather inflammatory. I agree that faith schools do tend to be sort of isolationist in the sense that they give over a worldview that may not lead to sort of the melting pot of multiculturalism. I that's why I'm against faith schools. But putting it in the context of leading to suicide bombers, I find that quite incredible.
And then, apart from anything else, he was going way beyond his own data, because all his data are about people in India, because he acknowledged it's impossible to talk to convicted terrorists in the UK. Well, there's also been some comment on the blog, because the way we covered it at The Guardian was to write a blog which allowed me to sort of be a little bit more opinionated about it rather than just writing a straight news story like some of the other newspapers. Woolly-minded Liberal, who is a regular poster on The Guardian's blog, said, "It's a shame that speculation from the lead author gets publicity and headlines in the newspapers, even when it's not backed by the study which is ignored. This is how the whole MMR business got started." I'm not quite sure it's the same situation as MMR, but I do I take his point, I think. Well, anyway, if you want to listen to more of that interview, go to the website and you can leave your thoughts on the blog.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
I'm Robert Winston. I'm Professor of Science and Society at Imperial College and new chair. And this is the Guardian podcast.
I'm going to give a talk which I've entitled Appetite for Destruction. And I'm going to argue that somewhere between 1.5 to 2.5 million years ago, mankind, free humans, invented the hand axe. And I'm going to argue that it's stone which separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And what's interesting about that is, of course, we know that the human brain starts to emerge as an increasingly enlarging organ, which is becoming increasingly dominant, way after the hand axe. And it seems that the hand axe, of course, as most paleontologists seem to agree, was a very important influence. What's interesting is our use of tools, therefore, actually influenced our evolution. As a result of having those tools, we hunted in groups, so we needed to communicate, and that improved our intellectual ability. And of course, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that eating meat and the lipids which occur as a result of hunting changed the brain from, let's say, around 950 milliliters to 1.5 or thereabouts milliliters. Now, the reason why that's interesting is because what I'm going to try and demonstrate, every piece of technology that mankind has produced, including that, has been downhill.
I'm science intern Marcus, and I'm going to be talking memories in distress with Dr. James Ost.
The reliability of memory is incredibly important in a number of domains, in terms of eyewitness identifications, a study of DNA exonerations in the States. People who've been on death row and subsequently got exonerated via DNA evidence found that something like 80% of them had been convicted on the basis of faulty eyewitness testimony. So obviously how accurate our memories are can be of kind of key importance in those situations.
And how do you start to look at false memories?
Well, there are a number of ways you can do it. Psychologists have used a number of methods, actually, looking at kind of word lists. Other psychologists have looked at whether it's possible to suggest that people have experienced certain childhood events that they never experienced, and found that you can convince people to give you reports that, you know, they were attacked by a dog as a child when that never happened. Our particular tack has been to look at whether people will tell you and appear to believe that they've seen non-existent CCTV footage of explosions and terrorist attacks and things like that. And we found consistently over about 8 or 9 studies now conducted by us and colleagues in Europe that this seems to be a robust finding. Roughly a third of your people will claim to have seen footage they can't have seen.
And you looked at this particularly with the 7/7 bombings. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It seemed like a kind of very appropriate event to try and tap. What we found was that participants would tell us that they had seen CCTV footage of the moment the bus exploded, not just the aftermath, which we all saw covered on the news, not any of the sort of images that were in the newspapers, not any of the kind of reconstructions, but actually CCTV footage of the moment the bus exploded. And if I can read a quote out for you from one of our participants: the bus had just stopped to let people off when two women got on and a man. He placed a bag by his side, the woman sat down and the doors closed. As the bus left, there was an explosion and everyone started to scream while a leg was on the floor. So obviously there's some sort of reasonable detail in that kind of account. Remember, they cannot have seen this event.
This is James Randerson, and you're listening to a special Science Weekly podcast from Liverpool. The Conservative Shadow Health Minister, Andrew Langsley, said recently that overweight people should be told there are, quote, no excuses for their condition. Well, the message here from Dr. Rachel Batterham was about as far from that as you could get. She says putting on weight and then being unable to lose it by dieting is down to an abnormal hormone profile.
The problem is that mechanisms that regulate body weight evolved in an environment that's totally different to our current environment. So we evolved during frequent fast and famine, and our biology evolved so that we would conserve energy whenever we had the opportunity. So having genes that allowed you to eat more when you were given a large meal would have been a survival advantage. The problem is now that we've got very high calorific food that we can eat very quickly, and we have decreased exercise. So it's absolutely undoubtedly the case that it's our environment, the change in environment, that has caused the obesity epidemic. And it's only by rechanging our environment or impacting on societal issues that we're going to have any impact on the obesity epidemic. The two common types of obesity surgery undertaken in the UK is the band, which is purely putting a band round the stomach, causing restriction. So basically the amount of food that you can put in is very limited. We only undertake about 1-2% of all of the patients for surgery actually have a band. The majority have the bypass. And what the bypass does is it staples off most of the body of the stomach so that you're left with a small stomach pouch, and then a piece of the lower intestine, well, mid intestine, is then linked up onto the stomach. Obesity is a chronic disorder. It's akin to having high blood pressure. Your high blood pressure doesn't tend to go away. And that's one of the problems at the moment, is most of the drugs are only licensed for 1 or 2 years. So even if you take them for 2 years and they're effective, as soon as you stop taking them, you put all the weight back on. The surgery is a cure, because you've had it and it stays like it.
My name's Tim Lang, and I'm Professor of Food Policy at City University in London. I think we're sleepwalking as humanity into a major crisis about food for environmental reasons: energy, carbon, doesn't matter which way you look at it, water, health, social justice, inequalities, urbanization, population growth. There are some big, big issues we've got to sort out. And we, the rich world, are carrying on as though it's just our right to eat what we like. I think we've got to start developing a different food system. We need different criteria by which to judge and work out what a good food system would look like. And I think science has got to play its part in that, not just the natural sciences or the food science or technologies, but also the social sciences. We know that what's happening at the moment ain't right, and we've got to help work out what the future should be. What would a good food system look like? We don't really know.
That was Tim Lang, Professor of Food Policy at City University in London, and the man who coined the term food miles. So, Jim, this issue about obesity, Andrew Lansley's intervention was pretty controversial. I mean, what scientists always say about this is that how fat you are, just like how tall you are, is a combination of both your environment and your genetics. And, you know, Rachel Batterham's point was very much, you can't just blame people for being fat. And quite often, you know, people who are kind of clinically obese, just telling them to eat less and exercise more just simply doesn't work. So, I mean, you know, was it helpful, do you think, for politicians to kind of wade in that way?
It makes sense, but I'm not quite sure we're at that point yet where people will take any notice of this.
Something else that I thought was incredibly complicated was what Tim Lang was suggesting, this kind of multifaceted food footprint that takes into account social and fair trade factors and environment and all these other things. What did you think, Marcus, of that suggestion? He was sort of saying we needed some kind of, you know, big panel of important scientists who can explain the evidence on these things and put standards in place.
Well, I think his main point is that we need to change our attitudes towards food. And he seems to be arguing for a very consumer-driven approach to that. So if we give consumers all the information, then they will make the right choices. I'm slightly sceptical that in the absence of economic change, economic pressures, consumers will make the right choices.
Well, we're seeing that at the moment, aren't we? With this sort of credit crunch, people having less money in their pockets, there's been, you know, a big drop in the... I mean, whatever you think about the rights and wrongs of organic food and whether it is better for the environment or whatever, the fact is because it's more expensive, fewer people are buying it and more people are kind of shopping in Aldi and places like that.
Well, the other approach is something like David King's advocating, a very sort of government-driven, technology-driven approach. But I think Tim Lang's right to point out that if you don't give consumers the information, then they don't even have the opportunity of making the right choices. So I think you probably need both aspects, and probably Tim Lang in his kind of comprehensive approach would agree with something like that, I think.
Hi, I'm Ian Pearson, Minister for Science and Innovation. This is a Science Weekly special from the BA Festival of Science in Liverpool.
We'll be hearing more from that gentleman on the Large Hadron Collider in just a moment. Also ahead, the tale of the Swedish nurse and a stroking experiment. I don't remember that story.
We developed a sophisticated stroking machine that had the characteristics necessary to excite these special nerve fibres we're interested in characterising that appear to be responsive maximally to pleasant light force, slow velocity stroking.
I wish I'd been at that press conference. That sounds really good. But first...
Producer Andy here again, and I thought it was about time to take 5 minutes out from talks about evolutionary colour, the mystery of magnetism and the cultural evolution of human groups. James has just told me to go away. He's busy writing his stories for the paper, so I thought I'd come and experience some of the delights Liverpool has to offer, starting with the weather. You can probably hear that. And over there, there's a tent. Perfect. Get me out of this torrential downpour. Right, I'm with Alan Ames, and a bit of light relief from all the science. Just tell us about what we've got in front of us here.
Right, well, we've got four birds in front of us here. We've got Alaska here. She's a 17-year-old North American bald eagle, barn owl, and a very wet female Harris hawk who's just stood out in the rain and had a bath. Well, they're all here today is to explain to the children about what I like to call the science of nature. You've got all these different adaptations within four predatory birds. One's designed to catch fish, specially designed feet for hanging onto slippery fish. You've got the highly manoeuvrable hawk here, which catches stuff that's close to the ground and on the ground. You've got the peregrine falcon, that's probably the fastest bird on the fastest thing on the planet, capable of 240 miles an hour. It takes pigeons out of the air. And you've got our little barn owl over there, who quarters the ground at night silently, trying to catch mice.
I was trying to get away from the science, and you brought some back even. Sorry. Talking about the birds. Do they make any noises, any sounds?
Yes, the bald eagle cackles. It's got a sort of a dog-like high-pitched cackle and bark. The barn owl hisses. It's not a twit-to-woo bird. That's the tawny owl. The barn owl screech and hiss.
Anything we can do to make them hiss or twit to woo?
Well, I mean, you're more than welcome to go over there with that microphone and annoy that huge great bald eagle.
It's looking at me already. I'm not going anywhere near it.
And she might make a little noise. I'll see if I can get her to talk to us. Well, she'll eat the microphone if you put it near her.
Well, I'll keep my distance. I don't think my boss will be too pleased about that. Anyway, break time's over, I think. Time to get back to discussing some dead clever science like the Large Hadron Collider and stuff like that. Let's see what's next on the list of talks to go to. Alcohol, binge drinking and cognitive processes. Sounds like it's going to be a good one. I'm here with Professor Theodora Duca and Dr. Matt Field. You've both been looking at alcohol, binge drinking, and the brain functions. Starting with you, Theodora, what's your latest research found?
We have found that when we compare binge drinkers to non-binge drinkers in tasks which examine the function of frontal lobe, in other words, functions like planning, deciding, being able to inhibit an inappropriate response, binge drinkers are much more impaired than non-binge drinkers, especially female binge drinkers.
And Dr. Field, you've been looking at some slightly different aspects, haven't you?
Yeah, so in a lot of the research I've done, what we've been doing is comparing people who drink relatively heavily versus people who don't drink at all, or who are light drinkers. And what we see is, and these people aren't tested when they're intoxicated, not when they're drunk, but what we see is we know a number of cognitive differences between these groups. So heavy drinkers tend to be particularly impulsive, and they tend to be get very easily distracted by alcohol-related cues in the environment. And much of the research that I've done is trying to untangle what causes what. So it could well be that alcohol causes brain damage, for example, which then leads to these cognitive changes. Or it could be that these cognitive changes might somehow lead people to drink more, and therefore they're not necessarily a consequence of heavy drinking, but they might be a cause of it. And much of my research has actually demonstrated that both of these possibilities are probably true. So on the one hand, heavy drinking can alter the way in which the brain functions, and this has a knock-on effect in that then if you've altered the way the brain functions, this then alters your behaviour, so you drink more. Studies from animals and from humans showing that when you look at particular cognition, so impulsivity, so when people are particularly impulsive, this can predate alcohol and drug involvement. So people who are naturally more impulsive, when they eventually come into contact with alcohol and drugs, they're more likely to develop an alcohol problem. And that's, I think, a fairly robust finding from both animal research and from human research.
So, having heard all that, I thought I'd conduct my own very scientific experiment on those subjects. And to do it, I'm here outside the world-famous Cavern Club, the place where the Beatles used to play, right in the heart of Liverpool, at kicking out time. Fingers crossed. After a heavy night drinking, can you remember anything?
Yes. Happy inane conversations with mates.
What do you forget?
How embarrassing you are.
How impulsive would you say you are?
That depends on your perception.
Okay, well, I've got a scientific test to test impulsiveness. And this is only hypothetical, I don't have any money on me. If I was to offer you £5 now or £10 tomorrow, which one would you choose?
Five an hour, probably. If you were offering me £1,000 tomorrow, I'd go for the tomorrow.
The only time I've ever forgot it on is when I was drinking vodka Red Bull. And that was it, basically.
And what do you forget? The good things or the bad things?
Well, the bad things. The last time I think I remember, I remember being sick. The next minute I woke up in my hotel room.
Would you rather I give you £5 now or £10 tomorrow? Which would you choose?
£10 tomorrow.
I can't claim it on expenses, though.
Right, I have had a few drinks, but I'll say this when I'm
You said you hadn't drunk a minute ago.
No, I'm not drunk. I've had a few drinks, there's a difference. If I was drunk, I'd probably be like tramps like that, sitting in the corner. But I'm standing.
How much will you remember tomorrow?
Everything. Because I told my husband I've been at 9 o'clock.
Why would you say you're impulsive? What have you done when you've been drinking?
Well, take tonight, for instance. I told my husband I was going to the pictures at 8 o'clock. And he's like, give me 15 million missed calls.
And it's 11:30. This isn't the pictures, is it?
No, and I'm not even really in the pictures.
Well, that concludes my scientific study for the evening. I'm not sure what that proves. I think I'll go back and analyse the data and get back to you.
Producer Andy there with his Science Weekly initiation out in Liverpool. Now, how much do you remember about last night, Andy?
I can't actually remember going out.
Good. Okay. You owe me for that bail money, by the way.
Science Weekly.
Now, there's a huge sign at Liverpool's Lime Street station which says, "Big things happen here in England's northwest." But even bigger things have been happening in Switzerland's southwest. If you're listening to this, there's a good chance the Large Hadron Collider hasn't ripped the universe apart atom by atom. Phew. That would have been a terrible waste of everyone's time and money. So while I got to spend the week in Liverpool, Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample drew the short straw and was dispatched to CERN in Switzerland.
There's a sense of excitement here at CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory on the outskirts of Geneva. After nearly a decade of building, scientists will finally try out their new toy, the $10 billion Large Hadron Collider, the largest, most complex machine ever built. It lies 100 metres beneath my feet, and its job is to unravel some of the most enduring mysteries of the universe. Lynn Evans is the project manager for the Large Hadron Collider.
I think that the first study I made of the LHC was, in fact, in 1983. But it was only in 1993 that the project was ripe to present to the Council of CERN for approval, where I became the project leader, and the project was approved in 1994. And it's been 14 years in the design, prototyping, and the construction.
$10 billion is a lot of money to spend on one machine. How do you think the LHC is going to justify its price tag?
$10 billion is not such a big price tag. I don't know how it compares with the Hubble telescope, for instance, of which it is truly comparable. I mean, Hubble is looking out to outer space, we are looking to inner space. It's considerably cheaper than the Beijing Olympics. Now, the scientific program of the LHC is involving scientists from all around the world. I think it is truly a world machine. It's a unique machine, and it will certainly advance the knowledge of mankind. Now, having said that, I think we also know that pushing technology to the limit, as we do, always has spin-offs. Now, the LHC, we do not know what it will bring, apart from the wonderful science that will come out of it. We will see, but we are already working on a much, much more powerful infrastructure like the World Wide Web, which will allow scientists to handle the massive data that's coming out of the machine. This is called the grid, and it is all already showing a lot of interest. Where we lead, generally the others will follow.
That was Lynn Evans, project manager of the Large Hadron Collider. One of the things scientists hope the machine will discover is the Higgs boson, a particle that is thought to explain the origin of mass in the universe. The particle is named after the Scottish physicist Peter Higgs, who couldn't make the big switch on.
I got my photograph plastered all over the papers in April after a group of us, including Richard and myself, visited the LHC at the time that they had the open day at CERN. Being there in the hall with the detectors and so on, the scale was even more colossal than the impression I'd gained from photographs. So that was one thing. Another thing which impressed me very much was the way in which the things like the detectors and also the machine itself had been put together from components which were manufactured all over the world, and the organisation of this I thought was a great achievement, and get it right so that when it all came together it would all fit. That I think is a colossal achievement.
Were you at home this morning when the broadcast from CERN was coming through?
That was at 8:30, was it? I mean, I must have been at home, but I hardly ever listened to the radio anyway, so I wasn't listening. I was too busy getting myself ready. I probably wasn't even completely awake by then. And normally, I'm not completely conscious until after breakfast.
How would you celebrate if they found the Higgs boson?
Well, I have a bottle of champagne in my wine store already. I haven't moved it into the fridge yet.
So from the uber high-tech surroundings of the Large Hadron Collider, it's back to the Student Union bar at the University of Liverpool. Although there is a pretty high-tech looking fruit machine over there in the corner. Before I bring in our guest, theoretical nuclear physicist Jim Al-Khalili, here's Britain's Science Minister, Dr. Ian Pearson.
We've got 500 million pounds of government money that's already gone into this. We've got around about 250 government scientists working at CERN, and another 250 or so here in the UK. So we're very well represented when it comes to the particle physics community. And we hope it is going to tell us some brilliant new things about the origins of the universe.
obviously it's a large commitment of government money and resources and scientific expertise, and that's attracted some criticism. You've probably seen some of the comments from David King, who it was questioning, you know, should we be spending this amount of money on something like this when there are big problems of climate change to face. Do you have a comment on what he had to say?
Well, I don't think David King's really criticising CERN and the Large Hadron Collider. He thinks it's an exciting experiment as well. What David's rightly saying is that we need to do more when it comes to tackling climate change. And he's absolutely right. But let's not get away from the fundamental importance of the research that's being conducted at CERN through the Large Hadron Collider. We hope it's going to produce some fundamental new insights into the nature of dark matter, for instance. And there's a lot that comes out of accelerator technology that can have medical benefits as well. So this investment in basic science is not just important because it's curiosity driven and it can provide insights into things like how our universe evolved, but it's also the fact that from that basic research, some really practical future applications could well come as well.
Science Minister Dr. Ian Pearson there. I can always kind of hear the sigh in the physicists' voices when the inevitable question about black holes has been asked. Are you kind of looking forward to never being asked that question again, Jim?
Well, I think if nonsense like we're going to get swallowed up by a black hole is what captures the imagination and gets people talking about particle physics and the universe and science in general.
And it actually did, didn't it? People in pubs across the land were saying, oh, this could be our last
it's
night
been
out.
Incredible. And I think no scientist thought that it would capture the imagination like it has done. I think it's actually not a bad thing at all.
It all seemed to go pretty well as far as the scientists were saying. Where do we go from here? Because it was a largely artificial milestone, really. It was, there were no collisions happening. There was no data being collected. What happens next?
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, I think scientists certainly on the day all breathed a huge sigh of relief, not because we didn't get swallowed up by a black hole, but because everything worked the way they'd hoped. I mean, just the electronics and the computing and so on, and no magnets broke. Everything seemed to work fine. Now the fun starts. Now, they have to calibrate and ramp up the energy of their beams of protons. That'll take weeks, maybe months, before they're up to speed and start taking data. Then it'll be further many months while they analyse the data. But the fact is, in a year or so, hopefully from now, we will hope to be discovering new particles, whether it's the Higgs boson or whether it's supersymmetric particles or even possibly making mini black holes. Whatever we discover is going to lead to new amazing new picture of the universe. So the fun starts. It's just going to take a while.
Marcus, you're not a physicist, but coming in from outside, I mean, do you feel as if, you know, this particular festival has been kind of, I don't know, taken over a little bit by the LHC? Have people been talking about it round and about?
People were talking about little else. I think the two things really worked well together. I just wonder how much they're talking about the BA over in CERN.
Actually, there's one thing I wanted to see if I could clear up with you. I heard a rumour that they scheduled it for the 10th of September because that was the day that Andrew Marr was free to anchor it. Is that true?
I'm sure it would have all been built around Andrew Marr's diary, absolutely. Since once Radio 4 decided they were going to spend the day broadcasting from CERN, I think $10 billion US dollar experiments will have had to bow to a greater power.
Okay. what we're saying is Andrew Marr is more powerful than the Higgs boson, basically. He's
but everyone
greater
knows that,
force
surely.
We did know that. Remember, for everything you want to know about particle smashing experiments, head to guardian.co.uk/science/CERN. That's CERN. There you'll find our special half-hour CERNcast. That's a podcast about CERN, if you see what I mean. And check our iTunes feed and the website for the latest Science Weekly Extra podcast, which has more of Ian's trip to Switzerland.
My name's Dr. Linda Mountain. I'm a senior lecturer in the Department of Engineering at the University of Liverpool.
Now, your talk's entitled Speed Cameras, Lifesavers or Revenue Raisers, and I fear this might be a very short interview. Which one is it?
It's both, actually.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
And now for something completely different to end the show.
Producer Andy here, and I've just stepped out into the campus here at the University of Liverpool, and throughout the week there are a whole series of talks and presentations, dozens, catering for all scientific backgrounds, from just members of the public to people doing PhDs in particular fields. I'll run you through a couple of the sessions on the list here. The physics of sport, Bend It Like Beckham, one for the kids. The science of superheroes, can't believe I missed that. Can science ever be a humane study? A bit of ethics. 8 o'clock in the morning, Einstein was a refugee. I was in bed for that one. Didn't quite make that. Quantum physics on TV. A very popular one. Why the one you fancy never fancies you. I think I could probably have given that lecture. And another that's caught my eye here. The importance of touch and the pleasure of stroking. Well, let's go and see what Professor Francis McGlone has to say about that.
I won't ask you guys to do this, or chaps or girls, but if you touch the person next to you, they feel the touch, and then you know that something else will waft in, depending on who it was that touched you. So I think that's these two sides of touch, understood at the neurophysiological level.
We've been trying to characterise and understand aspects of touch that are mediated by what you would call grooming behaviours, the sorts of stroking movements that we make when we groom ourselves and others, and why it's so rewarding.
And you've had to build a machine, especially the RTS, is it?
Yes, to understand sensory systems, we apply good old-fashioned psychophysical procedures, so we need to control touch, its movement, and importantly, its force. So we developed a sophisticated stroking machine that had the characteristics necessary to excite these special nerve fibres we're interested in characterising, that appear to be responsive maximally to pleasant light force, slow velocity stroking.
Very quickly. So if you stroke, and in fact you almost might experience it, if someone starts stroking in the same place repeatedly, you get pissed off in the end. It actually becomes, it can become unpleasant. So, you know, you want to be stroked all over, I suppose.
And you've come up with some statistics or some figures for optimum force, optimum speed as well.
When we look at the human behavioural responses, as well as the response from the nerve itself directly, the nerve fires optimally and people respond optimally when the movement velocity is about 5 centimetres per second. So between 3 and 5 centimetres per second is judged nicest, and the nerve fibre itself is firing most actively at those velocities. And again, these are part of the stereotypical sort of grooming movements that people make whilst they're grooming.
We're all wired the same. If I stick a pin in everybody, they're all going to respond in terms of those pain systems being activated, and they'll feel pinprick. You all have the same thermal pain threshold, 47 degrees, you'll go ouch.
Can you explain the Swedish nurse phenomena?
The back of his hand was being stroked by his partner or by a control person. And the hands were equilibrated for temperature, so the hands didn't feel cold. So basically, the back of his hand was being stroked. And he knew in which situation who the stroker was. So a familiar person, if you like, was touching him, his wife, and then the control toucher to expose that social context. And that's where the brain area that we would have predicted would be activated by the pleasant affective aspects of that touch was activated more by the stranger than by the wife.
And she was
attractive.
Yes.
And we did tell him and her.
Well, I'll tell you something, you don't get Swedish nurses on the Nature podcast. That's it for this week, I'm afraid. Check out our special webpage on the BA Festival with plenty of extra juicy interviews we couldn't squeeze in here, including why the Twin Towers collapsed and fighting chimps. Head to guardian.co.uk/science/blog to comment on anything we've talked about in the show. You can also post your cerebral ponderings on our Facebook wall. Before we go, Marcus, what was the most astonishing thing that you learned last week at the festival?
I thought the neurons that love being stroked are great, and I also think it's brilliant that we're starting to talk about invisibility cloaks. And I just wonder what fun we could have if we put those two things together.
What about you, Jim? What did you take out of last week?
Sorry, I've just been completely blown away by Marcus's favourite piece. My mind's gone a complete blank now.
Well, I discovered that that women remember their dreams more than men. I didn't know. Apparently, that's well-known to scientists, but I didn't know. I thought it was quite cool. Well, thanks very much indeed for joining us, Jim. And it's goodbye from all of us at Liverpool. The science baton has been handed over to Guildford for next year's extravaganza. Science Weekly is stroked into shape by Andy Duckworth with help from BA Media fellow Marcus Pearce. I'm James Randerson. Normal service should be resumed next week. Goodbye. I can't believe it. I managed to get all the way through that without saying, countdown.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.